learning to play your edge. Often we've looked at finding a balance between energy or effort and rest and relaxation in the meditation practice. You know from your own experience that mobilizing too much effort can leave you tight and tense. It's also likely to engender unnecessary judgment and lead you to be discouraged about your practice. And you know that allowing an excess of relaxation to take hold often results in drowsiness and a sort of sloppiness of mind. So tonight we take time to explore an approach or a dynamic, a lesson that typifies the balance between energy and relaxation. This is a lesson we could call learning to play your edge. Picture yourself on a Monday morning beginning your week. A coworker coming in tired and cranky makes a statement that really yanks your chain. You start to react defensively and then, just for a moment, recall something you once learned about nonviolent communication, about looking for the being behind the words and the need or the pain that may be there. The urge is strong to zing a zappy one-liner, but it's too late for knee-jerk reactivity. You now have a choice. You have come up against your edge. Or a friend wants you to join her trekking in Nepal. You'd love to go, but looking down from great heights leaves you dizzy and weak. You know that this trip would repeatedly bring you face to face with your deepest fears, your edge. Or maybe you meet your edge at home when boredom has set in. You're not really hungry, but by habit, your feet insist on walking toward the refrigerator. You open the door. Looking right over the carrots and the orange, your gaze settles on the chocolate fudge cookies. Just one won't hurt. The hand picks up the entire bag, the feet walk to the TV, and the body settles in. Just before you turn on the movie, you become aware that you have bolted two cookies and are about to swallow a third. Now, surely one of these scenarios has a ring of familiarity. We live in the same world and we are not that different from one another. If we're attentive, we see that life is continually bringing us choices, opportunities either to react out of deep conditioning or to step aside outside the habitual and look at other possibilities. This is not to say that all of our usual responses are somehow undesirable, only that every moment brings a choice, and frequently a clear challenge at our edge. I was already musing over this topic some time ago when a guest speaker brought us the provocative challenge from the book Moral Imagination by John Paul Lederach. We were invited, for example, to consider talking in depth with another person with whom we deeply disagree, or to take a risk in the service of some life-affirming change for ourselves or for the world. Pema Chodron sees this as the real meaning of the word renunciation, a word from which we often recoil in dismay. In her book, The Wisdom of No Escape, she says, "Renunciation does not have to be regarded as negative. I was taught that it has to do with letting go of holding back. What one is renouncing is closing down and shutting off from life." Finding ourselves at our edge assumes that we have reached a point of discomfort or of insecurity. Somehow, in some way, the very next act or word will reveal to us something about how far we have come, or not. How disconcerting. How pregnant with possibility. And what a ripe condition for learning. What's really striking is that this is the very phenomenon we meet again and again in sitting practice. With each breath, we are challenged to stay, to keep the body still, and to open to the moment-to-moment change of experience. The teaching is that rather than reject anything, we are to practice receiving each moment as a gift with as much love and tenderness as we can. In Vipassana practice, we are actually training for renunciation in its true sense, training for living out life on our continually shifting edge. Meditation practice, by its very nature, brings us steadily closer to our edges. As the mind stills and the view clears, we see more directly where we are not. These insights may seem very mundane and unimportant, but they combine to forge an understanding that is huge in its import. For example, on retreat, I noticed myself licking my lips. I didn't recall the decision to do so, or even noticing dryness of the lips. But at some point, dryness registered and judgment was made that this was unacceptable and needed to be tweaked, needed to be fixed. I saw others in the same predicament, moving an arm or a hand or a foot just a bit so that then I can meditate, and believing it won't matter. But it does matter. What matters is not that we moved, but the automaticity of the reaction. In fact, in that moment, the restlessness, the urge to fix or tweak, has become your meditation. There is no experience which is unacceptable to the open heart. Playing our edge in formal sitting practice is the willingness to simply stay. So as we sit, we increasingly see the mind as it uses any ruse to flee from, to refuse the present moment. Seeing that we have refused our edge isn't a weakness. It's a moment of mindfulness, a sign of aliveness, of openness. It takes a lot of metta, a lot of tenderness, to play our edge in meditation. Pema Chodron says, whenever you realize you have met your edge, you're scared and you're frozen and you're blocked, you're able to recognize it because you open enough to see what's happening. It's already a sign of your aliveness and the fact that you've shed a lot, that you can see so clearly and so vividly. Rather than think that you've made a mistake, you can acknowledge the present moment and the teaching of that moment. Well, whether it's in formal sitting practice or in everyday life, there are some qualities that will serve us well in playing our edge. One is courage, the willingness to abide in the insecure place, not knowing, continually opening to the changes that come, and trusting basic goodness. This is a story about Itzhak Perlman. On November 18, 1995, Itzhak Perlman, the violinist, came on stage to give a concert at Avery Fisher Hall in Lincoln Center in New York City. If you've ever been to a Perlman concert, you know that getting on stage is no small achievement for him. He was stricken with polio as a child, and so he has braces on both legs and walks with the aid of two crutches. To see him walk across the stage, one step at a time, painfully and slowly, is an unforgettable sight. He walks painfully, yet majestically, until he reaches his chair. Then he sits down, slowly, puts his crutches on the floor, undoes the clasps on his legs, tucks one foot back and extends the other foot forward. He bends down and picks up the violin, puts it under his chin, nods to the conductor, and proceeds to play. By now, the audience is used to this ritual. They sit quietly while he makes his way across the stage to his chair, and they remain reverently silent while he undoes the clasps on his legs. They wait until he is ready to play. But this time, something went wrong. Just as he finished the first few bars, one of the strings on his violin broke. You could hear it snap. It went off like gunfire across the room. There was no mistaking what that sound meant. There was no mistaking what he had to do. People who were there that night thought to themselves, "We figured that he would have to get up, put on the clasps again, pick up the crutches, and limp his way off stage to either find another violin or else to find another string for this one." But he didn't. Instead, he waited a moment, closed his eyes, and then signaled the conductor to begin again. The orchestra began, and he played from where he had left off. And he played with such passion and such power and such purity as they had never heard before. Of course, anyone knows that it is impossible to play a symphonic work with just three strings. I know that, and you know that. But that night, Itzhak Perlman refused to know that. You could see him modulating, changing, recomposing the piece in his head. At one point, it sounded like he was detuning the strings to get new sounds from them that they had never made before. When he finished, there was an awesome silence in the room. And then the people rose and cheered. There was an extraordinary outburst of applause from every corner of the auditorium. We were all on our feet, screaming and cheering, doing everything we could to show how much we appreciated what he had done. He smiled, wiped the sweat from his brow, raised his bow to quiet us. And then he said, not boastfully, but in a quiet, pensive, reverent tone, "You know, sometimes it is the artist's task to find out how much music you can still make with what you have left." Courage, the first characteristic of playing our edge. Honesty, the willingness to see and acknowledge the truth that comes from the heart, even or especially if it's inconvenient or uncomfortable. Courage, honesty, precision, and on-the-spot diligence of attention that arises with the alert mind. Playfulness, this soft, light quality of mind, holding lightly our views, our self-image, not taking ourselves so seriously, letting go and allowing a sense of humor to grow. The quality of the warrior, involving focus, intention, and persistence, discipline in the sense of remembering what you really want. These are the words of Georgia O'Keeffe. "I've been absolutely terrified every moment of my life, and I've never let it keep me from doing a single thing that I wanted to do." Watch the mind for limit setting. The mind telling you that there's no way you can do this or that. Limit setting usually arrives in the form of a story of fear. What if? This is constricting for the life experience, and our buy-in reinforces the fear. It can be useful to ask yourself, who is it that's afraid? Who is this me that accepts the limits so quickly? Actually, the more we play our edge, the more fearless we become, pushing back the prison bars that keep our lives small and circumscribed. We come to see more clearly the whole dance, our bond with all other beings, and the incredible gift of life itself. This is William Blake. Blake wrote in the Songs of Experience about his guardian angel attempting to visit him, and while Blake fought him off, mistaking him for just another aspect of what he believed was the enemy. So he took his wings and fled. Then the morn blushed rosy red. I dried my tears and armed my fears with 10,000 shields and spears. Soon my angel came again. I was armed. He came in vain. For the time of youth was fled, and gray hairs were on my head. So, what would it be for you to play your edge in the coming weeks and months? Staying still on the cushion? Finding and registering for a retreat? Renewing contact with someone, saying I'm sorry? Giving away something precious? Saying I love you? Wake up wholeheartedly to it all. Dance the whole dance. Don't wait. Do it now. This is an anonymous piece. Life is a rush into the unknown. You can duck down and hope that nothing hits you, or you can stand up as tall as you can and show at your teeth and say, dish it up, baby, and don't be stingy with the jalapenos. We'll close with a story from Pema Chodron's book, the story about the ravens at her home. The wilder the weather is, the more the ravens love it. They have the time of their lives in the winter when the wind gets much stronger and there's lots of ice and snow. They challenge the wind. They get up on the tops of the trees and hold on with their claws. And then they grab on with their beaks as well. At some point, they just let go into the wind and let it blow them away. Then they play on it. They float on it. After a while, they'll go back to the tree and start over. It's a game. Once I saw them in an incredible hurricane velocity wind, grabbing each other's feet and dropping and then letting go and flying out. It was like a circus act. The animals and the plants here on Cape Breton are hardy and fearless and playful and joyful. The elements have strengthened them. In order to exist here, they've had to develop a zest for challenge and for life. As you can see, it adds up to tremendous beauty and inspiration and an uplifted feeling. The same goes for us.